Hi everyone, and welcome to my first update of 2024. Hope you've all had an excellent start to the year. I thought it'd be helpful to review how big of a year 2023 really was, and in doing so, figure out what that all means for 2024 and make some predictions that we can come back to in a year's time and see how accurate they are. Now, it's really a year where a lot happened. The tech industry got a lot of valid criticism from people like Peter Thiel, who said that we'll promise flying cars and all we got was 240 characters or whatever it was, which is a punchy line. And there was a lot of truth to that. All the development, which was quite significant, big increases in cloud computing and software and things like that. But it all seemed on the surface to be focus on making people spend more time glued to their smartphones, which is not necessarily the most productive thing. But 2023 was very different. These were like hard tech, serious revolutions. And in many ways, the world will not quite be the same after, and most likely significantly better. So the first one was large language models, and I'll cover this without saying the obvious things, but really it's like the first time you can talk to computers in natural language and have them talking back. You can ask them to write something, a poem, a rhyming sonnet from Shakespeare in a Shakespearean style, paint, draw, to code. I mean, this encoding is like a really interesting time, this middle period, where probably in the next year or two, you'll be able to ask computers to fully code and deploy apps. Now we're in the middle ground where you still need software developers with quite a high level of expertise, but they've basically become 10 times or more productive. The second revolution was in GLP-1s, which have been very well covered. Now these things have been around for a long time. The first active agent was isolated from the Gila monster, which is a poisonous lizard in the United States. Very strange introduction, but the concept has been around for a while. And these drugs have been in the market for a very long time, and there's been 10-year studies of some of them. So we do know a lot about these drugs, but 2023 was the year they hit the mainstream big time, became a topic of conversation. Millions and millions of people are already on them, and there's been huge impacts on health. And in 2023, there are also a lot of studies done on the broader health impacts, not just weight loss. And I think that is really the most interesting thing. And so far, it seems that the health effects are largely in line with what you'd expect by the 15 to 20% plus reduction in weight, and also that kind of leveling off of blood sugar that happens as well. So the combination of those two effects has positive effects on basically all your organs. And a lot of the early health worries about them have been disproved in large long-term studies. The third one was the first gene therapy approved, where CRISPR won approval for sickle cell disease, and Bluebird Bio, which has been in the works for a very long time, also won approval for their kind of lentiviral gene therapies, which are basically HIV used to deliver the change in gene. So what happens in 2024? This is the most interesting thing. So starting with large language models, it's fair to say there's going to be more compute, and everything that they're doing now is just going to be done better. Whereas before, they're making very short films and images. On the artistic side, you'll soon be getting clips of movies. There's already companies doing this. And potentially even you'll be able to do a whole full-length film just by asking the AI to do particular scenes in particular ways. And remember, you can talk to computers and they can talk back. You can ask them to change things, to adjust things, to change characters at the end, to change their haircut, all kinds of things, which wasn't possible. There's one thing we absolutely do know, and that this is going to massively increase the demand for computing than what it was otherwise. Now, this has very relevant implications in the stock market and investing, but it's also one of the few things that I think you can really pin your hat on. And there's only a handful of companies, after waves of consolidation, there's only a handful of companies left that will benefit from this. It's very different to previous semiconductor waves where they've involved an explosion of new companies, many of which, the vast majority of which ultimately go to zero, and the ones that don't generally get bought out by others. Now, on the entire supply chain, there's often only one or two companies that have the advanced technology to make these chips. We're also on a transition period. I saw a tweet the other day. I wish I could reference it better. I think it was, in any case, I'll remember who it was and post that later. But basically, it was saying we're in this middle period where if you know any coding, you feel like a genius. You're just so much more productive. Boilerplate code can be done. You can debug super fast. But there will be a point where you don't actually need very little expertise at all. Absolutely. You'll be able to ask a computer to build and deploy an app and change things all using natural language. But this glorious middle period for developers that will soon change and really open up access to all these kinds of technologies to everybody with a computer and an internet connection. I think there's kind of two directions software companies will move in. Developers are obviously vastly more efficient. So some companies will use that to reduce their overall headcount. So if you think about what happened in the software revolution, these were the The top SaaS companies were amongst the very top performers in the market. Many of them went up 20, 30, 40, 50-fold in the lead up to 2021, certainly by significant fundamental growth in revenues and users, as well as record high multiples, which both compounded to huge returns. But basically, all that value was captured by software developers. So there's this huge argument over how do you calculate stock-based comp? And I can see both sides. On the one hand, most of these companies are only diluting 1, 2, 3% a year. So if you're saying, well, if you're diluting 3%, but you're growing 40%, that's a great deal for everybody. But on the flip side, you do need to think of these as business. It is a cost, whether you pay it in cash or stock. It is relevant. And then this definitely got pushed way too far. We had this company like Twilio, which I've shared before, which was paying senior executive team, like chief legal officer, CFO, tens and tens of millions, even up to 40 or 50 million US a year in stock. And in doing so, the returns ended up being pretty bad. It reminds me of when people invest in like emerging market economies, and then the indices go nowhere for 20 years or 10 years or 3 years or whatever it is, even though the companies themselves increase in value in market cap many times. What generally happens in those economies is and markets is insiders control the companies, issue a ton of stock, constantly raising capital. The investors who are like, this emerging market is the exact right place to be, are right. The growth comes, the market cap increase comes, but the per share returns can be weak. And I think you've seen something very similar to that in software. But now there's an opportunity effectively for these companies to, you know, really be much more efficient, hire much fewer developers. And that's one direction. The other direction is where every developer is significantly better, significantly more powerful. So maybe it actually makes sense to continue hiring developers with that power. I lean towards that. I think with people becoming more useful at anything, you tend to hire more of those people and have them doing more and creating more value. I think that's the direction we go in. Nevertheless, I'm sure there's sky-high salaries and stock-based comp packages in the US, which are way out of whack, which, for example, a brilliant Indian or Eastern European engineer would expect. I'm sure that gap does narrow over time. And in 2024, the big winner was obviously NVIDIA. We owned this, probably should have made this a 10% position. It's smaller, sold throughout 2023. Still own a bit, but this company is just the best. They have software that allows developers, this CUDA software that allows developers to access the parallel computing that's available on their chips. And really, they're the number one. AMD does something similar and is developing, you know, open source version of their software. And I think AMD's probably outperformed recently because it was cheaper, it was less appreciated, but it's very clear now that all the big tech companies are going to swing their weight and support AMD and make huge investments to make sure that NVIDIA isn't the only game in town. And that's been good news for AMD, which is also one of our bigger positions. Another company that's probably deeply undervalued, probably the most undervalued, is Taiwan Semiconductor. So this idea that all roads lead to Taiwan Semiconductor. And the reason I say that is because there are companies developing chips. You've got Tesla, Apple famously with now the M3 chips, which are vastly more power efficient, make the MacBook Pros and MacBook Airs. They're the best computers on the market by a long way. They feel like smartphones. They don't heat up. They're as fast as when you're using a top-end smartphone. But ultimately, they're still made in Taiwan by Taiwan Semiconductor. So even as competition heats up and all these major companies invest in developing new chips, they're still basically going to the same place to make them. Obviously, Samsung is there, a quarter of the size, roughly. But really, Taiwan Semiconductor is the only game in town. And this is trading cheap, like 8.7 times EBITDA, way undervalued. Geopolitical risk, and my view on that is I think everyone's happy with the status quo. I think China likes beating their chest and insisting that Taiwan will one day be part of China. I think the Americans like the ambiguity. The Taiwanese are obviously building up their defense and sending clear signals that they're not just going to be walked over. And I think ultimately the cost-benefit analysis for invading Taiwan, it just doesn't really make sense because it's an island. I think it'd be different if it had a land border and you could just roll tanks over, but it doesn't. It has a big sea that has to be crossed. And missile technology and drone technology is pretty exceptional these days. So it'd be an extremely costly exercise to try and invade anyone by sea, even anyone by tank now, actually. I think it might have been different if Ukraine folded and that was a major success for Putin. I think it's pretty clear before he invaded Ukraine, there was that meeting with him and Xi where they said their friendship had no limits. And I'm sure the kind of secret aspect of those meetings was that they were going to support each other in their kind of any military expansions they did. It's pretty clear that was the undertext. But the fact that it turned into a very costly disaster, Putin, even though he now looks like he's on top, I don't think anybody looks at that and thinks this is something I want to do, particularly Xi. There was times when it looked like Putin's hold on powers was even at risk. So you can see here that actually semiconductors are still under a lot of pressure. So immense investment in the highest performing chips, but everything else is doing pretty badly. PCs and mobiles have been down. Automotive is up year on year, but down quarter on quarter. It's weird that there's been like this mix of an extremely explosively successful high-end computing part of the market, and then the rest of chips, notably anything consumer-related, has been exceptionally weak. Now, I actually think that cycle will turn. The people that didn't buy their phones and smartphones or pushed out that replacement cycle from maybe 1 or 2 years to 2, 3, 4 years, I'm sure that latent demand is going to come back with a vengeance, as it has every other time in chipmakers' history. And then you could get a perfect storm. And that's when you see things like NVIDIA at $1,000, things like Taiwan Semiconductor going to $200, pretty big moves in all these chip makers. So I really think we're early on in that. And it's also worth noting that there was a huge, on the back end of these kind of semiconductor crashes, you can have many years where they're the best performing asset class. And I think now, in particular, with this explosion in computing, the prospect of doing more computing on your mobile, the prospect of all these new apps that everyone's going to be using, that's immense demand for computing that wouldn't have been there pre-large language models. And the real lift will happen when agents become better and you have agents speaking to each other to book tickets. Maybe you ask it, you have two different like AIs effectively talking together. The amount of compute power that those things require is significantly ahead of database retrieval and search. So that is all still yet to come. That is all in the future. And while there might be 100 million plus users of ChatGPT, you're still very beginning in that curve of this becoming a mass product. So I'm super excited about these companies still. Now, there's talk of Sam Altman setting up his own kind of Taiwan Semiconductor equivalent in the United States. The reports are, this is from the Financial Times only, was it yesterday, a couple of days ago, that he's working with Taiwan Semiconductor, which probably makes sense. But even if there's this huge Middle Eastern investment in setting up an American competitor for Taiwan Semiconductor that can make chips, like a manufacturing competitor, all that money is going to be spent somewhere. So where's it going to be spent? It's going to be spent in companies like ASML. It's going to be spent buying the equipment to make these things and all the service providers that go into that. So this is still super bullish for semiconductors. Certainly anybody selling equipment to make semi. That one is GLP-1s. Now, I think the interesting thing here is there were issues around thyroid. Does it increase thyroid cancer when they're like stuffed rats full of this stuff? There did seem to be some issues there. So far, most of that, nothing has really been proven or seen in larger studies. There have been indications there might be health issues, but really in the big studies, which is what counts, these things have had huge net overall benefits. And that is the future. That is like the next phase of GLP-1s, where they start to be seen as these drugs that you lose weight, your blood sugar spikes less, and all your organs become healthier. You're a generally healthier person. And I think that's actually the way to look at these things. I think that is what lies in the future of the next year or two. One thing that is interesting is the Ozempic. There's a shortage now, the shortage, supply and demand. Supply will meet demand. Pricing will stay high for a while, but these things will eventually become generics. When they are, you can imagine the price is going to plummet. And that's when you'll see the big population-wide benefits. The next generation is also worth keeping an eye on. So Eli Lilly, in my opinion, is winning. Their candidates seem like the best. They've got one that has maybe 50% more weight loss than Ozempic that is in development now. I will have a better idea by the end of this year how good that one really is. And also there's oral versions. So one of the big hang-ups is actually the fact it's an injection. But there's already oral Ozempic available. It's just not made widely available. Because it goes through your digestive system, you need to take a lot more. So to have that effective dose, you need to take a lot of it. So the last thing Novo Nordisk really wants is everybody taking much more in a supply-constrained market. Another interesting consequence is Eli Lilly is investing heavily in early-stage biotech. Now, biotech is still in the dumps, even this year. Now, you look at these kind of companies, which have actually done pretty well in their clinical programs. Intellia, in particular, probably has cures for two diseases. There's competition for those in those conditions, but their results have been as good as you might hope. It's been one of the worst performers and no kind of recovery. And I think really one of the things that hit us last year is we got semiconductors very right. But we really thought that after those things moved, that would lead to a pickup in the smaller end of the market, which didn't happen. Which is good and bad. The good thing is the opportunity is still there. The bad is that it definitely put a bit of a dampener on us last year. And we're lucky that we had some things that kind of hit the lights out. to make up for these kinds of things. But it's pretty exciting. All these companies are sitting on massive cash hoards. They're sitting on massive cash hoards raised in 2021 still. You know, many of these traded below cash. And then companies like Beam is still raising money, doing deals. I think it's really interesting to see what happens with these companies. But the issue with these gene therapy platforms in particular is their revenues are very far out. And it's not entirely clear how things will be priced, how things will be paid, what consumers will go for. And I think there's one thing that's been really obvious over the last couple of years. The companies that have developed drugs that are effective have had enormous returns. The platforms have been exceptionally weak. It's almost like the specialist biotech investors are still the ones that are doing a good job, picking the right things, are doing very well. The people that just invested in platforms generally did not. And I think that's going to be the case going forward. And like one of our best performers recently was a company that has absolutely compelling data and a really interesting competitive position. And that has vastly outperformed these other companies, which have actually come out with cures and things. So the Vertex CRISPR therapy, that came out, it's approved. This is that third revolution we're talking about. It came out priced at $2.2 million. And it looks like insurers will actually pay for that. But this isn't a very good treatment. So sickle cell disease, the way this one works is by turning on fetal hemoglobin genes that are basically switched off, and then you have adult hemoglobin genes that switch on. Their Casgevy treatment works by turning these back on, or rather switching off the blocker, cutting the gene that blocks fetal hemoglobin. And they've cured people, but they're free of these severe pain crises, these heart attacks, these really horrible diseases, very common in communities in Africa and of African descent, because if you have one of these genes, it's a recessive gene, if you have one of them, you have significant protection against malaria. If you have two, you have this awful disease. So that's why I always had this gap, this evolutionary reason why sickle cell disease and sickle cell disease stayed in the population, because it did have a benefit. If you only have one, you still have to go through 2 weeks of chemotherapy. You're in and out of hospital. It's a month in hospital when you get that final infusion of the corrected. Like these are not trivial treatments. You know, you have chemotherapy that wipes out all your bone marrow. It's better than the existing standard of care, which is if you want treatment, you can go for a bone marrow transplant, which again means horrific chemotherapy, bone marrow transplant, and then like heavy doses of immune suppression drugs for extended periods of time, complications associated with that. So it's better, but it's not ideal. Ideally, you'd be injecting people with something rather than going through these multi-month treatment processes involving chemo. And that is actually where the next generation is, which is why we have a small investment in Beam. You want things that go in and fix the gene. You don't want something that involves these bone marrow wipeouts and infusing in maybe a cut gene or a gene where the relevant gene is being cut. Ideally, you just replace the base pair that's missing with the correct one and go on from there. So that's another question mark over these things. Like CRISPR, will this treatment be used in 10 years' time? I really don't think so. I'm unsure. The only thing in their favor is that it will take a lot of time for these next generation to hit the market. But it is probably a reason why these stocks have continued to trade quite weakly or considering. Having said that, I do think there's an opportunity in companies, especially these companies that have drugs approved or such compelling data that we know basically there will be, not very likely to. No guarantees in life. Things to watch. This is more for the GLP-1s. So there will be kind of trial readouts in sleep apnea. There's also ApneaMed will release their drug version for sleep apnea. This may move the market for all sleep apnea providers, of which there are a few, including a major one, ResMed in Australia. We also want to see the GLP-1 readouts when more data is done on heart disease, kidney disease. We saw data from Novo, but we haven't seen data from Eli Lilly yet. That's liver disease, fatty liver disease. And these are all things we're going to see over the next kind of 12 months. And each one of these things that it works for, it's just going to lead to a step change increase in value. And also, it'll push things in that direction that I said I think they were going. I think they're going to go from weight loss drugs to broader health drugs. I think that's like what's next for GLP-1s and the thing to watch. There's also risks. So Bluebird Bio had their gene therapy approved. This is like a lentivirus, basically HIV. Modified HIV delivers adult hemoglobin gene. But you know, they're priced at $3.1 million. These are such complicated, expensive procedures. They had to price it very expensively. This was approved in Europe, and basically no one, the European cover has refused to cover it. I had to be pulled from the market. And there's still huge risks, so in these gene therapy things. My personal view is actually that you're still better off in the biotechs. You're better off with the ones that have simpler stories for now, where the data is very good, where there'll be a market, even small molecules, which don't have the kind of glamour of these gene therapies, but do have a much clearer commercial story. Now, the funny thing is, I think like Bluebird worked. I think the gene therapies will work for many things, and this will be the revolution that everyone's expecting, but it's the commercial returns are less clear. And I think you have to, if you're investing in this space, you have to have a very clear understanding of that. And if you don't understand them, you can always look at companies like Bluebird Bio that got things approved and ultimately didn't make money for people. Now, I think I was first invested this in 2016. Finally, our topic in Australia is Clarity Pharmaceuticals, but I'm not really going to talk about that because I'm about to send out a big note on it. I might even do a video separately on why I like it and why in a competitive space with Lantheus, Telix, and Novartis it is that has Pluvicto, an actual treatment, Telix and Lantheus offer diagnostics, why I think Clarity is such a compelling opportunity. We bought a big chunk of shares at a buck and we have added to it. Probably think there's a pretty serious pathway to several fold increase in price from here. But I'll make that case in a different note. What else to watch? It seems like inflation has come down as expected, but has steadied where it is now. I think that's a question mark as to what happens next. I don't have a clear view. Had a very clear view that it was going to come down a year ago, back when everybody else was talking about higher for longer. That came out. That largely played out. From here, it's harder. Will inflation in the US go from 3 to 2? Just going to have to wait and see. What is clear is the central bank messaging has changed dramatically on that. There's talk of easing in the United States, and while there's Fed speakers come out and some kind of indicate there will be easing sooner, others come back and temper those expectations as the market gets ahead of itself. I think this is one to watch for 2024 rather than having any clear predictions. I might leave it at that. So I hope that was interesting, and I'll send out another update shortly on Clarity. And I'm sure this year will be as exciting as last year was.